I'll call the meeting to order. We now have a quorum. Representative Bradley, would you like to move your bill?
I certainly would, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 3913 for possible inclusion in our omnibus finance bill.
Please proceed.
Thank you. There will be testifiers. I don't need to do too much about this. I suspect that every person in this room realizes that we have a crisis in access for public assistance patients for dental care. And we have tried many, many approaches with different degrees of success, and we have had some successes. I know in my own community we have Samaritan Bethany Dental Clinic that the Salvation Army and volunteer dentists have helped out with, and that's been a great boon. But one of the things that we did that is particularly critical is to establish what amounts to a critical access funding route with an additional boost in reimbursement, because one of our most significant problems is that the dental reimbursement for public assisted patients is really below cost. And so what we did with the critical access is to provide an opportunity where it would be 25% above the normal rates. What happened to us was that the demand outstretched the budget. And we ran out of money, caught dentists sort of in half stream. The bill is fairly straightforward. It has sort of two provisions. The provisions, new language, are on page 4. One part of it in 4.6 to 4.9 is to provide a little bit more of an upfront planning so that the dentists who do participate in this critical access can have a better idea of what might be coming. And then in 4.23 to 4.26 is an appropriation section. It is blank. I can tell you, members, that if we were to try to entirely fund for this biennium, it would be in the order of about $9 million. And I just tell you that so at least you have some awareness. This will obviously be laid over, and we'll see what we're able to do. But that at least gives you kind of a size and scope of the issue. The preliminary fiscal note that you have does not include that because obviously it didn't have that number in it. What it does include is the administrative expense that would be required to support the language in this bill, and that is $53,000. And Madam Chair, with that, I would like to invite the testifiers, and then after that, if there's questions, we could deal with them.
Very good.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 3913 today. My name is Dick Dirks. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Dental Association. An association that represents about 3,000 dentists in the state. About 83% of the dentists are members of the Minnesota Dental Association. The Critical Access Dental Provider Program was proposed by the Minnesota Dental Association in 2001, and we're very pleased that the legislature that you all chose to adopt it at that time. In the subsequent 4 years since the program was adopted, the Critical Access Dental Program has helped to stabilize and maintain access to dental care, which is a problem area, as Representative Bradley just mentioned. But through the Critical Access Program, access has been maintained for those 4 years. Under the Critical Access Dental Provider Program, both nonprofit dental clinics and private dental practices are allowed to qualify for enhanced MA reimbursements to offset the substantial losses that they experience in their dental practices when they see MA patients. The problem that's addressed here is that for a dental office that sees MA patients, the more patients you see, the more money you lose. Therefore, through this critical access program, the philosophy is let's at least increase the reimbursements for at least some of the most critical MA dental providers so as to reduce their very substantial losses which they incur because of the volume of patients that they see. I know you know the basics, but just basically the basics for MA funding as it relates to dental office is that typically MA reimbursement rates cover about 40 to 45% of normal fee in a dental office. Fixed costs in a dental office usually are about 65%. So there's a gap in terms of just covering the fixed costs, and the MA reimbursement provides no income to the dentist himself or herself because of that rate of reimbursement. And that's why the critical access program has been important. It's filled the gap for key dental providers. The law as it exists allows for DHS to administer the program. They are allowed to increase reimbursements up to 50% above the MA rate. Over the last 4 years, they have been allowing up to 40%, but it's varied based on the patients that a dentist sees and so forth. 160 dentists have been benefited in their MA care by this program over the last 4 years. But the problem that has now occurred is that DHS has determined that the program has grown very substantially, as Representative Bradley indicated, and the costs have outstripped the initial estimates from 2001, and therefore through their own administrative procedures, the funding formula for the critical access dentist has been changed, and the way in which the formula works we support, but the amount of money available through the formula has been cut in half. And with late notice in late 2005, many of these key critical dental offices were given little opportunity to cope with a 50% reduction in the critical access payments that they've received, leaving them in a difficult spot and jeopardizing their ability to continue care for the MA patients that they see. Let me close with just a few basic numbers, similar to what Representative Bradley was just saying. The state has been spending about $4.5 million of state money. Now, there's a federal match on top of that, but about $4.5 million per year in state money for the Critical Access Dental Provider Program. The adjustment made by DHS for 2006 reduces that to $1.5 million from the $4.5 per year. We therefore are requesting a restoration of the amount that has been spent over the last years so as to keep the critical access dental providers whole. If that were to be implemented on April 1st of this year and then go through fiscal year 2007, that would be about $3.2 million. We believe this is an important program, and we would request and appreciate your support for keeping the program whole. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dirks. Senator Bradley, do you have another witness? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Helgeson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Dr. Michael Helgeson, and I'm a dentist with experience treating people with special needs. I'm also the CEO of AppleTree Dental. AppleTree is one of the 100 or so critical access dental providers in Minnesota that's impacted by this cut. We're a nonprofit provider. We have 3 clinics, and we provide mobile services at 116 community sites, including nursing homes, Head Start centers, group homes for people with disabilities, and schools throughout Minnesota. Last year, we provided over 40,000 dental visits. And in addition, our hygienists provided an additional 10,000 services using collaborative agreements, including some involving teledentistry, linking hygienists in Head Start centers with dentists at our main clinics. About 70% of the patients that we serve are enrolled in Minnesota public programs. So I really appreciate the opportunity to tell you briefly about the deep impact that these recent cuts are having on the safety net clinics, but more importantly, how these cuts will affect children, adults, and elders in every part of the state. Since January, when these cuts took place, we've had a chance to talk with many of the 100 critical access practices and clinics, as well as with the Minnesota Dental Association, the Minnesota Association for Community Dentistry, other stakeholders, and also with the Department of Human Services. And we've prepared a fact sheet that I'll leave behind today for people to review that answers a lot of questions that may come up in connection with this. I do want to especially thank the Dental Association for their strong support for the critical access providers, and also to Fran Bradley for the legislation to restore funding to 2005 levels. The most significant safety net practices, and these are from small practices in rural areas that are the only sources of care for miles around, to larger community clinics and nonprofits in larger communities and cities across the state. They're all hard hit by these cuts. I'd like to focus on what I know best, which is the impact on apple tree, but I want to emphasize that our situation is illustrative of the situation for dentists like Dr. Tom Sitzer, a pediatric dentist in Rochester, and Children's Dental Services, which provides dental care for school children in the Twin Cities area. Like them, our payments have been cut by more than 50%. For our clinics, the impact of the cut is more than $350,000. Again, we learned of this in late December, and the impact was effective January 1. We simply can't absorb cuts like that. I used AppleTree service statistics to estimate how many children, adults with disabilities, and frail elders might lose their only source of care based on this funding cut. I estimate we're talking about 60,000 Minnesota Public Program patients around the state. Where will they go? Recently, a patient named Deb needed a heart transplant, yet she couldn't get on the transplant list without having medically necessary dental care to free her from infection. If Deb had not been able to receive care at our Holly Clinic, where would she be? Emergency room, hospital, or worse? It's the 100 critical access clinics across the state, small and large, that are keeping patients like Deb alive. Why is this supplemental payment so important? Why can't these critically needed dental practices and clinics just absorb this cut? The reason is that these supplemental payments are the difference between being able to stay afloat and sinking. They raise the reimbursements above 50% of an average fee to a level that allows these clinics to sustain the programs. With these cuts, we're back to levels around 50% of a normal dental fee, which means we're losing money, we're sinking on every procedure, every patient that we're serving. So, I ask for your strong support for restoring the critical access dental provider funding, ideally retroactive to January 1st, to the same level that was paid last year. We're not asking for any additional funding. We're just asking to keep the program at the level that it was at last year. So I'd welcome any questions, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Helgeson. Do members have questions? No questions? Well, thank you for bringing this important legislation to it. Do you want to have a closing comment, Representative Bradley?
Yeah, I do, Madam Chair. A couple of things. First of all, I used the figure $9 million. I think it was sort of straightened out, but if we did replace all, as was indicated, it would be $3.2 million because half of it is federal and part of it was covered by the $1.5 million. That's one point. So what I'm saying is that that would be the maximum amount that the state would be obligated to if we tried to replace all. The second thing, I want to be sure that we're clear. This didn't happen as a result of legislative action. We did not make any cuts in the critical access funding. What it amounts to, however, of course, from an individual dentist point of view, it is seen as a cut because they were being paid at a rate. The money ran out suddenly, and there was some notice. I mean, it's not like it happened just without some notice. However, to the individual dentist, it absolutely is a reduction in rates for them. For their credit, I think some are still trying to do some voluntary work, and I certainly give a great deal of credit to my own constituent in the area, Dr. Tom Sitzer, who brought down some people from DHS and helped me unravel, because the first time I heard this, it didn't make sense. Now I really understand, and it's fairly straightforward. Maybe we should have done a better job of planning so we could have smoothed this out. That's not what happened. What happened now, and the victims are dentists who've been doing something really important for us, and that's providing dental access.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also had a meeting with some of my dentists and feel that this is important legislation. One more time, do any members have questions? Hearing no questions, the chair will lay this over for possible inclusion in the health policy and finance. I'm going to spell.
Is it Emmer time?
Emmer time. Spending time.
Representative Emmer, you have House File 3630. I'm sure you move for possible inclusion. And I believe, Representative Emmer, you have an author's amendment as well.
I do, Mr. Chairman. I would move the A1 amendment. And then if this is the appropriate process, I also have, if you want to move the amendment first, and then I would have an oral amendment to the amendment, or I could do it ahead of time.
Well, I think it would be best just to incorporate that, so if you can identify that change, you can just incorporate in that amendment motion.
Members, if you have the A1 amendment in front of you, the oral amendment to this proposed amendment would be to strike or delete lines 1.2 and 1.3.
I'm sorry,
1.2 and 1.3.
Oh, okay.
And then we would add that language at line 1.6. So at the end of line 1.6, where it says, quote, end health plans, we would add in mental health services, comma, including case management, close quote.
Representative Emmer will incorporate in Amendment A1, striking lines 1.2 and 1.3, and then on line 1.6, before the quote after health plans, you would insert in mental health services, comma, including case management. Do I have that correct, Representative Emmer? I have it correct, he tells me. I was just verifying your amendment, so that will just be incorporated. And now we have the A1 amendment. Anything to be said about the A1 amendment, or will that just be part of your presentation?
Mr. Chairman, it will be part of the presentation.
Okay, so this author amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Emmer, before you proceed, I just want to make sort of an overall. We are not planning to come back. There's quite a long list of testifiers on this bill. And we're going to act on the bill in this committee meeting. So I just ask testifiers who are testifying to be mindful of whoever's testified previously and try to be to the point so that we can complete our work. We still have quite a bit of time, but this is a fairly complicated bill, and we also need some time for discussion in the committee as well.
When you say act on, you mean to be holding over?
Be held over, right. Okay. Right.
Mr. Chairman, I do have one more minor oral amendment.
All right.
That I would like to propose on page 3, at line 3.3. The proposed amendment would be to strike the word shall.
Yeah. Are you replacing it with a different word?
Insert may.
Representative Emmer moves to amend House File 3630 as amended on page 3, line 3.3, to strike the word shall and replace it with may. May I comment to that? I guess that'll be the way you present it, but maybe this will be a time to cover what that might help certain groups that had concerns. Maybe that'd be a good time just to explain what the effect is. Commissioner, would you like to explain that?
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Goodnow, Commissioner of Human Services. That was an amendment that we asked Representative Emmer to move today to address some of the concerns that consumer groups have expressed about the transition period between the current system and integrated network. We continue to have issues, and we want to continue to work with consumers to try to make sure that the transition is a smooth one for them. And this is our attempt to work on this, but we know it's still a work in progress as this legislation goes forward.
Thank you. Any questions to that amendment? The amendment, all those in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, House File 3630 is a governor's initiative to integrate mental health and physical health care. You're going to hear from various folks from the department, including the commissioner, who will explain the proposal to you. It's basically three areas. First, the integration piece. Second, the coordination between state and counties. And third, the financing piece. We expect that you will hear some discussion on the latter two issues in terms of how that coordination should take place as opposed to what's proposed. And you'll also hear some discussion on the financing. But I think there is strong support, agreement, and in fact some excitement over the proposition of the integration of these two areas of medicine. And with that, I'll introduce Commissioner Goodnow to go through the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Goodnow.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Goodnow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kevin Goodnow, Commissioner of Human Services. This proposal that's before you is the governor's proposal with regard to the mental health initiative. And it's based on the work that has been done with the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, which has been meeting since the fall of 2003. The proposal before us is based on the work of that group in addressing the issues of access, quality, and accountability in our mental health system. This is an issue that we're concerned about because many Minnesotans with mental illness do not receive the care they need when they need it when it comes to mental health issues. And that very often people need to be very sick before they can access needed mental health services or appropriate services. What they do when they do access the services, they experience a fragmented system with varying levels of care and care coordination or lack thereof. We have components within the system that are very good and very effective, but as far as the system goes, the entire system is very fragmented. And quite frankly, there's very little incentive for early identification or intervention with regard to mental health issues. And the system right now artificially separates the mental health system from the physical health system. The proposal itself, in a nutshell, it spends $50 million in new money over the next 3 years, and there's $59 million in addition to that in redirected funds. The proposal begins with the principle that mental illness is a brain disease, a health care issue that is most effectively treated with integration of other health care and with coordination with social services and education. And the reason for that, and the reason it's so important that it be integrated, is that there's an absolute link between mental illness and such other physical diseases such as diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. Those are well-documented links. In addition to that, mental illness is also associated with a high risk of breast cancer and heart disease. Also, there is a lack of preventive care and care coordination today for people with mental illness. 60% of psychotropic medications for children are prescribed by primary physicians without mental health follow-up. So they're just being prescribed the meds without being prescribed or without having any care follow-up with regard to that. In addition to that, the health plans report that about 80% of all psychotropic medications are prescribed by primary physicians. So in reality, we really do have a system that is crossing over and is integrated in a sense, but it's not effectively integrated model. Approaching mental illness as a health care issue is a critical step for achieving parity for the mental health care system. This proposal brings parity for mental health in our state's publicly funded program, health care programs, and we believe it is the first step toward parity for mental health in all of our health care programs. This proposal recognizes that investments in mental health can help prevent other unnecessary costs. For example, more than 25% of the caregivers in our MFIP program received a severe mental health diagnosis within the past 3 years, 25% of our welfare caseload of our caregivers. 30% of children in the child welfare system have serious mental health needs. Up to 70% of the youth in juvenile justice system have mental health disorders that are typically undiagnosed and untreated. And in our criminal justice system, our correction system, 16% of the adults in our system have mental illness, which is three times greater than the general population. The proposal that we have in front of you today in this bill has three main components. The first component is a comprehensive benefit set across the medical assistance program, the general assistance medical care program, and the Minnesota care program. Under the proposal, all these programs would have the MA benefit set. Right now, they have different levels of benefits that they would receive. The MA benefit set would include crisis services and other supports that help people get treatment short of hospitalization. It also provides additional services for aftercare when people, so we try to prevent them from going back into the system. Right now, because of the varying benefit sets and the different programs, we do have people that transition from one program to the other, and this will also allow for continuity of care. So for example, people on GAMC, as they get a job, start becoming self-sufficient, they bump up to the Minnesota Care Program. We want to make sure that there's a smooth transition between the programs when it comes to the delivery of mental health services. The next major component in this proposal is the integrated care model, which Representative Emmer mentioned. The integration, as I mentioned before, is very important, and it goes both ways. When I first became involved in the mental health issue, I was concerned about making sure the people that access the physical health system, that the general practitioners who are prescribing the medications know what they're doing and know what the proper diagnoses are and what the proper treatments are. But likewise, people with severe mental illness typically have their mental health provider as their primary care physician. And a number of those people, studies have shown, their physical health needs go undiagnosed. For example, a lot of people think that they're dismissed because they think they're psychosomatic. And so there's a need for that integration to take place. Under the legislation, consumers must be involved in the development of an RFP to develop preferred integrated care networks for the delivery of mental and physical health services. Consumers will be involved in this and consulted in this process as we go forward. And we have push this out as far as the implementation to the first stage of the phase in to January 1st, 2008 to allow for that participation to make sure we have that smooth transition. The amendment, the oral amendment that Representative Emmer offered today is a step towards working with the consumers to make sure that, you know, we know that we need to go to the integrated model. The issue that we need to deal with is how do we get there in a way that doesn't negatively impact the consumers that are currently in the system. And we're committed to working with consumers as we go through with this and go through this entire process, and as this legislation goes through, to make sure that we have that smooth transition. Finally, there are targeted grants in this bill to develop Minnesota's mental health infrastructure. And I should note that not all of the grants will be listed in the bill because some of them are carried as riders in their overall bill, but the policy language behind it is included in here. We recognize that the state and counties have a responsibility for supporting the mental health infrastructure beyond the integrated care network that I described before. So besides the integrated care network, we still need to support and develop and support the development of the services that are out there. The grants would go for such improvements as higher reimbursement rates for psychiatrists and other crucial mental health care professionals in the system. Actually, fairly generous rate increases included in here. Also looking at shoring up the basic children's mental health services in the schools. With some of the changes on the federal dollars that are going away from the local collaboratives, this money is meant to replace the money that's being pulled out of that current system that's already there. Also, dollars and grants are here to develop a statewide crisis intervention and stabilization system as a first line of safety net for children and adults, and also to develop capacity to address the mental health needs of specialty populations, people with eating disorders, ethnic minorities, and other groups that require special attention based on their cultural needs. So that's it in a nutshell. That's the general overview. I also have Don Allen from the agency here to go through the proposal in more greater detail if you wish that to happen at this time. And I would please want Don to come forward. At this time, I'll have Don Allen come forward and go through it in a little bit more detail.
And members, I would suggest as we're going through it in more detail, if there are questions for clarification along the way, let's do that. I mean, this is pretty complicated. I've spent a fair amount of time, and I'm still sort of struggling understanding. So if there's questions along the way for clarification, I would certainly welcome those. I think it's decent.
And Mr. Chair, one thing that may be helpful is as we go to get a sense of where we are now, so we know what we're changing to, if there could be kind of a preliminary comment a little bit.
That's a good point. If that doesn't take us all morning here now.
No, I understand.
Also,
a comment, Mr. Chair. If Mr. Allen could mention if there's anything in here that also combines chemical health and developmental disabilities and mental health care, because those systems are pretty fragmented or pretty separated at this point, too.
Mr. Brown, are you up to the challenge?
Chairman Bradley, members of the committee, I'm Don Allen, and I'm feeling a little busy right now. in response to Representative Thiessen's question about where we are now, if you step back and look at the big picture in mental health or publicly funded mental health services in the state, I guess, you'd see that we have 108,000 adults accessing publicly funded mental health services, 44,000 children receiving publicly funded mental health services. About half of those are accessing a combination of county-provided services and services through our public health plans. Another about half, the other half, are getting those, getting that care delivered solely through our public health care plans. So that's one of the issues. We passed back in 87 and 89, Comprehensive Adult and then Children's Mental Health Acts that set up a county-based system of care that was focused on the most severely disabled, those people who met the criteria for severe and persistent mental illness and severe emotional disturbance for children. Access to care in that system varies from county to county. Counties are not responsible for providing services beyond their available resources, financial resources. Counties have throughout that time, or throughout the last 10 or 15 years, put an enormous amount of their own funding into the mental health system. There's currently counties are putting in about $110 million a year from county property tax and state aid sources. This is one of the reasons, because there's so much variability between the amount of resources that each county has, that there's a lot of variability in the system that's available to people today. One of the main things that we were asked to address when we embarked on this project with MHAG was to try and do something to address some of the geographic access problems that existed, to bring more continuity of care for the system. And so I hope to also show later how that works. I hope that suffices. Okay. Let's see. I will try... Okay. Chairman Bradley, Representative Goodwin, regarding the intersection between mental health care and chemical dependency care and developmental disabilities care, the proposal we have before us, I should say at the outset, does not really do anything to integrate or change services to the developmentally disabled in the state. It does not do a lot to integrate mental health and chemical dependency services. The current care delivered through the health care programs for chemical dependency services for the people that are eligible for them will be better aligned when the mental health services are brought in to join them. We also have some of the infrastructure grants in the proposal that are aimed at supporting evidence-based practices, and we intend to use some of those to further the resources available for dual diagnosis, combined mental health and CD treatment.
Thank you.
Okay, Chairman Bradley. I will go through the proposal in roughly the same order that it's on the budget page. That's budget page one, and then I will try and take you to the bill and the amendments as necessary in order to do that. As Commissioner Goodnow mentioned, this has been a product of a very open and public process. We've tried to make it a very inclusive process. There have been times that I think there was 1 week earlier this year that I actually spent more time in meetings than I spent sleeping on this particular issue. But that said, I'd like to turn your attention to Section 2 in the bill. And it provides in Subdivision 1 and 2 some of the a continuation of some of those values that have brought us that to this far. It provides that as we go in this process that we continue to consult with consumers, families, counties, tribes, advocates, providers, and other stakeholders. We've done that over the last 2.5 years, and we certainly continue to do it. It also provides that we'll come back to the legislature in a year and tell you what we're doing, what we think about the changes that need to be in the system. The author's amendment that we just added added some additional language to this to specify that we're going to talk about the mutual roles in the system of public health plans and counties, that we're going to further define those, and that we're also specifically going to be addressing the issue of case management, which is one of the lingering items on the to-do list that we have as we embark on this project. It also guides us or directs the commissioner to take steps to ensure the continuity of care for people as we're affecting, affected by these reforms. And the amendment we just took around the enrollment is an example of that. That we ensure client access to available protections and appeal processes as we go on. Finally, this section gives the commissioner authority to make necessary budget transfers to manage the transfer of responsibility for clients between counties and public health funds.
Mr. Allen, can I ask you just to make sure I've understood? Changes are proceeding under this section. However, in January of 2007, there's going to be recommendations in amending. Now, is that just experience-based modifications, or is it... I'm trying to figure out whether we're putting implementation before the plan or what here. Can you position that?
Chairman Bradley, this provision came first off as a recognition that by proceeding in this direction, we are taking some steps that change the role, the relative roles of public health plans and counties in the provision of mental health care. And that we want to continue to have that discussion to continue to define and refine that relationship. One of the biggest issues that's still out there happens to be the case management issues, and there's a lot that has to be resolved before we can deal with that and come back with recommendations. We're trying to honor the MHAG process. We have a work group in that process that's continuing to work on care coordination and case management issues, and so we're waiting for that group's work products and recommendations. We also have the curveball that the federal government threw us in the Deficit Reduction Act, changing targeted case management reimbursement. We need to wait and see what are the federal rules that we're playing by in terms of how that gets paid for and reimbursed. So there are some things that are still pending, but we have enough of a direction and enough of a plan that we feel confident in proceeding at this time.
Well, Mr. Allen, would you expect if we had fiscal note in this and in the out years is a fair substantial increased investments, would you expect that these changes would affect in any major kind of way the forecast for spending for this initiative?
Chairman Bradley, no, I do not. I think that the case management issue is really going to boil down to what extent do we transfer money from state grants into health plans. It'll
Thank
be
you.
This kind of a thing.
So, Representative Walker, do you have a question?
Yeah, just a quick one, Mr. Chair. Ms. Allen, on page 3, line 10, I'm just curious with the C paragraph. I'm looking at the D paragraph, and it talks about consulting families and representatives of the consumer for the plan itself. However, under the C clause, it talks about if the individual is refusing to choose a plan, that the commissioner will just assign. I'm curious to find out why not involve the family and other representatives if that happens. I mean, it says to choose, you may do it, but you may not do it. Because why not being specific and saying we're going to involve the family if that consumer declines?
I don't know if you had a chance yet to explain Subdivision 3.
Chairman Bradley, that's correct. I'm wondering if Representative Walker would allow me to address that when I get to it.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Chairman Bradley, members of the committee, the first component that Commissioner Goodnow described that we're trying to do within this proposal is to achieve a comprehensive mental health treatment benefit set across all the public health care programs. In order to do this, the Medicaid benefit set, the medical assistance benefit set that we have, approximates what the MHAG work group developed as a model benefit set. We'd like to extend those benefits into general assistance, medical care, and Minnesota care for adults where those benefits are now lacking. So this expansion of the benefit set is handled in the bill in sections 14, 15, and 16. Those expand the benefit sets in the GMC and Minnesota Care program so that they match those available in medical assistance. We're adding, in this case, adult mental health rehabilitation services, assertive community treatment, intensive residential treatment services and crisis services in 2007. Case management, because of the issues I outlined earlier, we're delaying that the inclusion of that benefit until 2008. Sections 11, 12, and 17 address the part of the transfer of grants that we use to manage this and exempts those services from some of the rateable reductions that were established back in 03, I think, to reduce some of the amount of the capitation that was paid.
Mr. Allen, if I could make a suggestion, I don't see any of us have our budget books with us because I think we were kind of looking at the pages are in there. I'm sorry, I stand corrected. We do have it. All right, now. I was just going to suggest that we track as much as possible the order of the bill and the summary, but when you bounce around a lot, I think it's harder to follow.
Okay. Chairman Bradley, if you'd prefer, I could do that. I think it's a little bit easier to talk about the concepts and then tie it to the bill.
Why don't you, if you've got that, your structure, go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'll just try to keep up.
Okay. The expansion of the benefit set in GMC of Minnesota Care is financed through the transfer of state mental health grants to the public health care programs that are being expanded. The clients being served currently by the county side of the system will now get their services through the health programs. And so the monies that match up, and we're very intent on matching very carefully the amount of the transfer so that we don't take any more money from counties than we are taking responsibility for providing treatment and care to those clients. We'll go over to the healthcare programs. We anticipate that there will be somewhat better access in those programs when it is offered on an entitlement through the healthcare programs. So that 85% of the utilization will come from the transferred grants and another 15% will be covered from new funds brought in for that purpose. The second major component of the proposal is around the integration of health care and mental health care, and this takes place in two parts. First off, within our Medicaid program, PMAP, and medical assistance, we have a number of services that aren't available through prepaid plans and are only available on a fee-for-service system. Most notably, these are ones that have a county share in the cost of them, targeted case management, and children's residential mental health treatment. The proposal is that in 2008 that these will be available to PMAP enrollees and enrollees in our prepaid plans when they're enrolled in the prepaid plans, that they don't have to go outside into the county system on a fee-for-service basis to access those two services. It can all be done within the plans. We're also intending to use the contracting authority we have to promote the integration of mental health and physical health care, as Commissioner Goodenow outlined earlier. The second part of this is the regional projects. And the regional projects will be where we are demonstrating pulling people who are currently getting all their health care on a fee-for-service basis into this kind of integrated environment. There are two classes or two categories of folks that are currently purely in a fee-for-service basis. These are people who meet a disability criteria or people who meet SPMI or SED criteria and have the ability to opt out. So all persons with disabilities are in fee-for-service, and those persons with SPMI or SED have the option of participating in a prepaid plan or not. There are about 3,000 kids and about 1,000 adults statewide who have exercised that opt-out option. These are people who are obviously having a rough time with their mental illness, so they've met disability criteria or been diagnosed with a serious persistent mental illness. Many of them have a significant need for social services in addition to their health care treatment. As we worked as a group, we discovered that there were many ways that you might work to provide the integrated health care and then maintain the coordination of the availability of the social services that this population needs. After wrestling with that for a while, it became obvious that perhaps the best solution had to be determined locally. In mental health, we often work building from our strengths, and so that communities could look at where they had strengths. Where did the county and a health plan have a good working relationship? For instance, St. Louis County and Medica have been partnering on some very exciting things. to build on those strengths on a regional basis. And so we decided, rather than try and do some kind of statewide implementation, that we would walk before we run. And we would allow communities on a regional basis to come forward with a plan for how they would integrate health care, or mental health care and physical health care, while maintaining the link with social services. The partnerships that come forward must have at least the members in the partnership must include a county, must include a health plan or county-based purchasing entity or some other entity that's able to assume risk under the prepaid health plan laws in our state. They also may include other partners such as children's mental health collaboratives or education. Then within these plans, the once accepted, they would enroll persons with disabling mental health conditions into the prepaid plans. And their case management, children's residential treatment would also be provided through those health plans in those areas. We anticipate that no more than 20% of the state would be involved in those regional projects at the outset. And the author's amendment that was put in place actually limits us to 20%. There was a feeling that we should, again, walk before we run. And so we decided to agree to limit the extent of the implementation of the first phase. as we go into this process or these regional projects, they're online to start in also in calendar year 2008. Section 3, which Representative Walker asked about a little earlier.
Actually, Mr. Chair.
Said Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it was under Section 2. It was right before the Section 3, and you touched on it.
Oh.
Line 10.
Okay. Chairman Bradley, Representative Walker, in this part of the bill, it says that if a person with serious persistent mental illnesses or emotional disturbance declines to choose a plan, the commissioner may preferentially assign that person to a prepaid plan participating in the integrated service network. And so this is within those regional projects, and it provides that if somebody, when we come forward and say, hey, we put this together, it's time to choose a health plan. If they decide not to choose a health plan, then we would preferentially assign them to the one that had developed the special relationship between the county social services and the integrated health and mental health care. I think it's important to note that existing law around health plans gives people an enormous amount of flexibility around choosing health plans at the outset. So if they, after being enrolled in that situation, find that they don't like that, that they get to change any time within the first 90 days that they're within a health plan. They also get to change with the open enrollment at the end of each year. And I believe that there is one other opportunity within their first year that they can change all of those changes without any cause whatsoever, just by them mentioning that. So, you know, if they are assigned to this health plan and they don't like it, the next day they can get themselves assigned to another one.
Mr. Chair.
President Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, I appreciate that piece of it. I guess for myself, it'd be nice if the department put some thought to, you know, on line 15, under that clause, it talks about involving the families and other representatives. And especially since we're dealing with individuals that may be at a crisis point and may just say no to a health plan, to involve the other loved ones in that person's life that knows that individual the best would be helpful.
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Chair? One more question on that section, if I just
just for clarification, we're beginning to get into some advice, and that's later.
Well, this would be clarification, yeah. Understanding.
Okay.
the counties and the health plans are going to partner in these regional projects? Is there going to be more than one in a region? I mean, we're talking about choice. I mean, what would the choice be?
Mr. Allen?
Chairman Bradley, Representative Thiessen. Many counties have more than one health plan operating, especially in metropolitan areas. Within that region, all of the health plans would be responsible for providing the whole mental health benefit set, but we wouldn't require the partnership at the outset to include more than one of those health plans. You start with where your relationships are working. That'll set some standards, and then it can be expanded to the other health plans. I think that the other health plans would be very interested in getting that competitive advantage once that's in place. But it allows the counties to work with a single entity in order to kind of negotiate the framework within the region that they're doing. So initially, I think that there will be multiple plans. Now, for people who choose those plans, they get the entire benefit set, and the county is still responsible for providing social services. It's just that what is lacking in that arrangement is the special relationship between the county and the plan, in agreement on how they are going to coordinate the care for the people in the system. And the intention is that that will be phased in later.
Okay. Mr. Allen, proceed.
Okay. Chairman and members of the committee. Also, to Representative Walker's point, I think I should point out that earlier on in I keep saying Section 3, but I mean in Subdivision 3. We will also during this year be engaged in a process with the stakeholders to determine what the criteria for those partnerships would be. What is the performance criteria? And I think we will involve consumers and families, and I think the kind of point that Representative Walker raises about contacting and working with families would certainly be an acceptable criteria that might be specified in the RFP. And could enter into the process in that mechanism.
President Paul, I'm sorry, I skipped over before. Did you have a question earlier?
Chairman, I can wait until he's done. I just had a general question.
Please proceed.
Okay. Chairman Bradley, so in the process of putting these projects together, again, we need to consult with stakeholders. The projects are again financed when they come online with a transfer of state grants, which is used to buy out the county share of the services that are being moved. There are also in this process some significant one-time cash flow costs that have two sources. When you move a person from fee-for-service into managed care, because of the difference in the timing of a prepaid plan, which is prepaid, and a claim-driven fee-for-service system, which obviously is paid after the service is developed, there's a cash flow cost. And that cash flow cost is for that person's whole health care. So that has to be bought. Also, because in the 03 session, there were some delayed grants whose, what was it called? I think at the time it was referred to as an accounting shift. But the grants for a particular calendar year were being funded out of the second state fiscal year. And in the process of accessing the grants that were applicable to the time period that we're buying the services for, there's also a cash flow cost. And that results in a little bit of extra cost in 07. And a little bit of savings then realized in 08, kind of the reverse of the county shift that happens. The net cost of that whole process, with assuming 20% of the state's involvement or 20% of the disabled population involved, would be $109,000 in state fiscal year 7, which is just administrative cost, $5.9 million in 08, and then a savings of $1.9 million in state fiscal year 9. Those savings are from the grant buyback and those dollars are then reinvested elsewhere in the proposal.
Excuse me, Mr. Allen. I'm trying to get a little bit nervous here about the time. Do you have a feel for presentation since you're kind of skipping around? I'm not really sure where we are and how much more time you think you might need.
Chairman Bradley, I think I can do it in 5 or 10 minutes.
That's fine.
Depending on
questions. That's fine.
Okay. The third part of the proposal was a variety of infrastructure investments. These infrastructure investments are really designed, by and large, to do two things. First off, they're to cover the care of persons who are uninsured or underinsured in the system. And secondly, they're to develop and ensure that there's service capacity available, not just to serve public clients in the county or our public health care programs, but also the private plans. We have a lot of problems maintaining specific kinds of services in the state. A good example is crisis services, and then also specialty treatment services, services for ethnic and minority groups, as well as special treatment needs like eating disorders. Those are two services that are very hard to maintain, one from the specialized nature of the care given and the other because of large portion of uncompensated care costs. The other infrastructure investments monitor and track the availability of acute care beds. This is so that people can be directed by crisis, law enforcement, first responders to the hospitals that actually have the capacity to serve them. We are intending to make grants to support evidence-based practices, local adoption of those. Also within the bill, in Section 13, there's a provision that would address some of the shortages of mental health professionals, increase access to their services by paying an enhanced rate for a select group of services. Finally, we intend to implement an outcomes measurement system so that we can improve our accountability for the system. I would refer you, in the interest of time, that to the blue handout in the package you've gotten. There is a couple of pages on each of these investments, and if you have any questions, that's a great first place to start. Section 3 of the bill relates to county maintenance of efforts. Making these large investments, which in state fiscal year 9 and in the base amount to $25 million a year, we're interested in making sure that the counties maintain their investment in the system at the same time. As I said earlier, they've got about $110 million. That's an investment that the mental health system cannot afford to lose. And so we propose to implement a maintenance of effort. It'll be based on the average of this calendar year 4 or 5 expenditures in mental health services. The bill also, in sections 18 and 19, repeals 3 existing maintenance of effort requirements. So we're gaining some administrative simplification for the counties. They don't have to look in 3 different directions to see how they're doing against the maintenance of effort requirements that are there. Finally, in sections 6 and 7, there are provisions that increase the county share of uninsured RTC and community-based hospital placements. We're doing this in order to improve some of the incentives in the system. Currently, an uninsured client placed at NOCA Regional Treatment Center, the per diem cost is about $500 a day. The amount that counties actually spend on that is 20% or $100 a day. Many of the services, the adult mental health rehabilitation services, ACT teams, that would be appropriate services upon release are a good deal more expensive than that. What we're proposing is that after 60 days, which is a good 15 days beyond the average length of time it takes to stabilize somebody at the facility, that the rate of county participation in those costs would jump to 50%. Bringing it up to about $250 a day, which is more on par with the community-based services that we're talking about. And we're doing this to provide an incentive. It does also, though, produce some revenue in state fiscal years 8 and 9, $3.2 million in that regard. Other sections of the bill that I haven't covered yet, Chairman Bradley, sections 1 and 4 are put in there to clarify.
Chairman Ripson Huntley.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Allen, you just finished on section 6. And why, it sounds to me like the counties are going to be punished for the failure of the health care plan to deal adequately with these people. So why do the counties have to pay that, if I understand that correctly?
Mr. Allen. Chairman Bradley, Representative Huntley. The health plans will be responsible for any of their enrollees that are hospitalized in a state facility. They'll be responsible for the entire cost of care. The counties are only responsible for the persons without insurance. Now, I think I'll leave it at that.
Mr.
Chairman, I didn't hear the first part of your response to Representative Huntley. Could you repeat that? Who would be responsible?
Chairman Bradley, Representative Powell. For persons enrolled in our public health programs and that are enrolled in the prepaid plans, those prepaid plans will be responsible for the full cost of care in the regional treatment centers.
Okay. Thank you.
Proceed.
Other sections that I haven't covered, sections 1 and 4, clarify that for the counties, this is language that they requested, that the counties are not responsible for services when they're covered by the public health care, or when they're covered by a health plan. Section 5 reestablishes general grant-making authority in the Children's Mental Health Act. This had been repealed in 2003 because it was connected to the Community Social Services Act, which was repealed at that time. Section 9 removes some obsolete language, and then Section 19, the repealer, removes some of the previous county maintenance of effort, as well as some obsolete reporting and rate adjustment language. Finally, I'd like to just remind folks of the outcomes that we're trying to achieve. We're trying to achieve improved access for mental health services. We do that with the expanded benefit set, increased use of health care programs, which brings equity to access across the state and across county borders, the infrastructure investments, which should help preserve or ensure that services are available for our folks, and in a very concrete way, the psychiatric bed tracking system, which will help people actually find them in the emergency time that they need them. We also want to improve quality and effectiveness through the integration of mental health and physical health care, the incentives that the single payer provides for earlier identification intervention, by removing incentives for cost shifting, which always lead to a bad outcome for the consumer, it seems. And we want to improve accountability. We're clarifying the mutual responsibilities between the health programs and the counties. That helps. We're implementing an outcomes reporting system, which will also help us with accountability. And finally, we're going to be able to draw on best practices to improve the performance standards that we have in contracts with our prepaid plans. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Any Griffin Wilkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Allen, you had mentioned in your presentation that you're looking at doing an enhanced rate for mental health providers. Could you tell me if that's in the same area as the mental health providers that got a pretty substantial increase in the last 2 years or so? Because I know the department was within their allocation that they had was able to boost it substantially, and I'm thinking like 30-40%, but I could be wrong about that, because there was lack of activity, so you were able to just kind of refinance it, I think. But
Mr. Allen?
That same area?
Chairman Bradley, Representative Wilkin, you have an excellent memory. We are specifically not increasing those areas that recently got a raise. I can't really improve on it, but at page 6 of the blue handout, it lists exactly who's getting them and for what services. We are not providing rate increases for any of the cost-based rates, any of those that got that increase that you referred to just a couple of years ago. We're also not increasing rates for services when that's a negotiated rate, say, for instance, between the county and the provider.
Thank you.
Representative Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Allen, thank you. You've spent quite a bit of time in my office on this, trying to get this explained to me, and I appreciate it. But I'm going to ask... I see that we are having changes in the payment rates for residential services. Professional services are going to get increased rates in some instances. I see better coordination between health plans and counties. There's a lot here, but what I'm not hearing, and maybe I just missed it, was that when I talk to professionals and providers, they tell me the critical need is in mental health inpatient beds. What are we doing on that end, or are we doing anything on? I know that we're doing things, you want to do things in crisis, but crisis intervention is not inpatient treatment. So where are we putting these people once they get identified and in the crisis centers?
Strong.
Okay. Chairman Bradley, Representative Powell. We're trying a couple of things, certainly on the front end. The evidence-based practices grants, some of that money will go into the metro area where we're having some of the worst problems with psychiatric beds in order to get on the front end, sort of community treatment teams, intensive residential treatment services, and build that capacity so that there are some other options in addition to the crisis services to work on the front end. Also, the sort of community treatment teams serve as resources for getting people out into the community quicker. So that's one of the things. The other thing within the proposal that we expect will have a direct impact is the tracking system in order to us efficiently connect people up with where the openings are.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as a follow-up, as a comment, you know, the tracking system's fine, but having said that, the folks in the emergency departments are constantly fishing for beds, and they talk to people. Should be more, it's going to be easier for them to solve a tracking system, but the fact is the beds aren't there, and a tracking system would only confirm the same thing. So this is the problem that I'm hearing about, and I understand you're trying to manage it on the front end, but we're still not doing anything, it doesn't appear, to help us out on mental health beds. Just a comment.
Thank you. Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of my questions are, in this bill, there's a central, and I don't know what the exact word is, central with psychiatric patients. And that sounds great, but what's happening in our area is they're actually going to our area, and then the people in my area who need the psychiatric beds, they're full, and so then they are in the hallways of the emergency rooms, even though, you know, we put $1 million a year into those facilities. They're coming out from the metro area, and then we're being displaced. And so is there a way to, I understand the central area of dispersing, but how do we get around losing the beds that we are paying for in our rural areas?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Trump, and also to Representative Paul's comment. We do need to build infrastructure in the metropolitan area so the metropolitan area isn't shifting folks out to the rural areas. The whole issue of emergency room beds is it's a system, the entire system we have to deal with. It's not just if you take care or build more emergency room beds that you're going to solve the problem. Just like in the physical health system, when somebody comes in for emergency room needs, they're not maintained in the emergency room or in emergency room beds indefinitely or for a long period of time. Typically, they're stabilized and they move to other types of beds. What this proposal is talking about doing is building infrastructure around that next step out of the emergency room bed so you start opening up that flow out of the emergency rooms. That's one of the ways, it's not the answer, it's one of the answers and one of the ways that we're trying to help that situation where you can, where you open up the flow out of the emergency rooms once the person's stabilized to get them the appropriate level of care and the appropriate beds so they don't need that high level of emergency room treatment. If we can build that infrastructure in the metro area and the rural areas, there will be less of a need for the emergency rooms because they'll flow in and flow out. Right now, we don't have a good system on the flow going in and going out of that of those emergency room beds. And that's what we're trying to develop is that flow for that entire system.
Mr. Chairman,
what's important
to that point? What is happening now is these people are being warehoused for 24, 48 hours or more due to a lack of places to place them in hospital for inpatient treatment. Okay, so the specific question, I guess, and maybe you've answered it, maybe I'm just not getting it. What are we doing about that? How are we throwing these people out of there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paul, part of the issue is the people that are in those other beds that have already been stabilized, that are waiting for community placements or being able to be transferred in the community.
Okay.
They're holding up that they're clogging the process, or clogging the flow. So if we start providing for the treatment in the community, they can start flowing out, and then that allows for that transition to cycle through.
Okay. I understand. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm about to suggest, I believe we have two amendments in our packet that could be acted on. I think that people who have these, I'm hoping that we could dispense with them fairly quickly. I'm looking also, I want to make sure we have the maximum time possible for testimony. But we could act on these and then hear testimony. I don't think this will take a long time. If it does, then maybe I'll just table action and get right to testimony. So why don't we try... Representative Abel, I think you have an amendment, AO6-1403.
And Mr. Chair, that's been discussed with the department. There's an amendment coming to reflect their concerns, so I can talk of, in fact...
If it's not ready, then it's maybe better hold off. Okay. Well, then let's just hold off on amendments, and
I'm sorry.
I think it's time to give people the chance who are here to testify. I'm particularly anxious for people who come from out of town. We'll follow this, and then we'll kind of watch the time. We'll start with the order that we have for testifiers, and I first of all have, I believe, we wanted to switch, so Michael Skandrit wanted to testify first, and then Bill Conley, and I'd ask each of you, particularly those of you who are entirely in favor of, we may have most of the people that way. If there's concerns, it's really important to bring those to the attention of the committee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Michael Skandrat. I'm with Howland Health Consulting, and I serve as staff along with the Citizens League of the Mental Health Action Group. And I'm just here today to give you a really quick background on the Mental Health Action Group, because it is a place where a lot of the ideas that you're hearing today emerged. And I'm not going to speak to the bill and let others do that, and I'll try to keep my testimony very brief. About 2.5 years ago, virtually everyone who works in the mental health system or uses services was reaching the same conclusion that the current system was not working well for people, and also concluded that each of them working individually in their own areas, whether that's hospitals or outpatient, were also not going to solve the problem because it was really a system-wide problem. So the group came together at that time to see if they could work together, both to make changes in the private sector without the need for legislation, but also to work together to bring ideas to the legislature on how these system problems could be addressed. And the Mental Health Action Group is entirely privately funded. It's not part of government, but the private sector leaders who formed it did ask Commissioner Goodnow to serve as co-chair because of the significant involvement of the government in mental health programs. What the group did is, rather than do another study of all the issues in the system, the group looked at all the past work that's been done and moved immediately to what are the actions that the past commissions, task force, and reports have all agreed are the major problems with the system, and what are the major solutions. We focused entirely where there was already consensus about the direction to go. The four areas that were identified as the biggest problem, one is the lack of integration of mental health services into healthcare and not treating mental health as a healthcare condition. The second one was lack of coordination in the system, too many different parts of the system that aren't connected, making it very difficult for people to get the services that they need. The third is lack of accountability. No one seemed to know who was responsible for paying for or providing different services, and consumers didn't know where to go for help. And that resulted in a lot of cost shifting back and forth between different parts of the system. And finally, the way that mental health services were paid for was not good for consumers, because it often would pay for example, inpatient psychiatric services, but not pay for the services that would help people stay in the community and not need inpatient psychiatric services. It seems very logical, but yet the system that we have does not reward earlier intervention and treatment in the community to avoid the need for the higher cost care. So those are kind of the four areas that the problems were identified, and then we also looked both at the past work that's been done, but also spent a lot of time with all the consumer advocate groups, the family groups, and each of the major advocacy groups are represented on the Mental Health Action Group Steering Committee. In fact, that group is the largest single group represented on the committee, and each of them went back to their members to try to find out what consumers and families felt were the directions we should go. We combined that with what we had learned from prior reports and identified these six areas that became the principles for developing a recommendation to the legislature and the governor. One was the integration of mental health services into the healthcare system, and then to coordinate other non-healthcare services with that medical and mental health care. The second is to simplify government programs so that they're easier to access for consumers and so they know who is accountable for making sure that their needs are met. The third is to improve the payment system, to look at what should be covered in health insurance and public programs, to make sure all those services are covered so that the money is going for cost-effective services, for community-based services. The fourth is to be very clear about responsibilities, and we'll talk a lot, and others will talk a lot about the responsibilities, counties, health plans, the state, the consumers, provider groups, and the goal of this is to make sure that everybody knows what their job is and that consumers know who is responsible for problems that may occur in the system. The fifth principle was to start looking at results, whether the services and the money that's being paid is producing a better outcome for consumers, and there's been a lot of focus on how we measure that statewide and what kind of information can be made available to consumers and families. And the finally is a principle of partnerships, that this is a very complicated delivery system, and it will be essential that different parts of the system are working together better than they have in the past. And MAG has done a lot of different work. We've had more than a dozen different work groups that have led to recommendations, many of which have been implemented already through voluntary action of health plans, providers, and others. Some you have enacted in previous years. And there's also ongoing work that's continuing at the Mental Health Action Group. And I'm not going to spend the time going through those today because of the shortness of time. But one of the key issues that the Action Group has been working on for 2.5 years is the public program payment system. And this is where a large group of stakeholders from the Mental Health Action Group got together to develop the principles that should guide a payment system and also to develop the framework for the payment system. It was at this time that the Mental Health Action Group asked the commissioner and the governor if they could endorse these principles and would be willing then to begin to develop the actual system. And the governor did issue a letter and express support for the Mental Health Action Group process, and also then directed the department to develop the proposals that are before you today. I'm going to hand out, if I could, a list of all the members of the steering committee, and I think you'll see that there's very broad representation on the group. And just want you to know that as this process continues, and it's intentionally here today as, I wouldn't say half-baked, but not fully baked, because we do want to get it out there, get a direction set, and then we want to continue to work with all the stakeholders that we had for the last couple of years to make sure that the concerns are addressed, and we want to do that as we always have at MHAG with transparency and being very inclusive to allow people to participate. So we will continue to do that, and as problems emerge or issues between the different groups, we see that as part of our role is to help resolve those issues, bring people together to find solutions so that by the time this is ready to be implemented, we feel on balance that people are comfortable with the direction it's going. That's all I need to say today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Are there any questions?
Thank you. O'Connor?
Thanks. Again, remind people, unfortunately, our time is short here, so if you can be as brief as possible. I'm a working committee.
Mr. Chairman, Bill Connolly, representing the Mental Health Association. Mental Health Association, as Mr. Scandrett pointed out, has been involved with MPEG since the fall of 2003. And some of the reasons that we're supporting this is that the principles and the reasons for change as developed by MHAG, that mental illness is not treated the same as other medical conditions, which perpetuates the stigma surrounding mental illness. Access to services is spotty and not the same across the state. And one of the big problems in trying to really change the system is that existing payment methods do not promote early intervention. A lot of the services we develop require the individual to have failed or become very sick before they're available to them. Mental illness, there is a biological brain disorder, and treatment for mental illness should be incorporated in the mainstream of the healthcare delivery system. Integrating healthcare is a first step in achieving parity in the mental health system. We do believe that all three elements that are being proposed in this bill, both the benefit expansion across general assistance, medical care, and Minnesota care, is important, the infrastructure, and then the regional projects. We see, as has stated, that this is going to be a lot of work in the coming year and a half, and that there would be a report back to the legislature in 2007. The Mental Health Association adopted a rather lengthy resolution regarding this, and a number of the issues that they noted actually have to do for the RFP process, and I want to just briefly note some of the things that they want to focus on if this bill passes in their work in the next year and a half. One is that the RFP outlines the standards of care, including case management, and that requirements for integrating health care, mental health treatment, and social services, the RFP must demonstrate that the composition of the network is sufficient to provide the full complement of services needed by the population to be served. Also, ensuring that all health plans, not just the integrated one, will have to comply with best practice standards, abide by performance and outcome measures and related reporting requirements, and that this information should be made available to the general public as well as consumers. And lastly, ensuring that all health plans have the same service utilization reporting requirements, standards for access to mental health professionals and services, and care coordination standards, and that the standards and requirements, along with data on compliance, should be available to consumers and the general public. And these are issues that we have let the department know that we plan on working on in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. Peggy Hagman? Paul Wilson?
Yep.
I bet that's not Peggy.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilson, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Paul Wilson. I'm a commissioner from Olmsted County, Minnesota, and I'm here today to represent, obviously, our county, but also the Association of Minnesota Counties and MICA, the Metropolitan Inter Association of Counties. We estimate that in Olmsted County, there are 5,500 adults and 1,750 children with serious mental illness. Of the adults previously mentioned, 2,100 of these adults have serious and persistent mental illness. I first want to say quite clearly that all 87 Minnesota counties applaud this effort to address critical issues around mental health care, including prevention and early intervention, equal access to evidence-based treatment and services, creation of a system that's both accountable and affordable, and that's consumer-centered and that begins to erase the stigma of mental illness. Our mental health system, as we know, is all too fragmented. AMC and MICA recognize the system reform is warranted. The primary goal of counties is to assure that this new system will, in fact, improve services for the people, including those who are the most vulnerable due to serious mental illness. A secondary goal for counties is to ensure that we continue to have the resources to be at the front line in providing safety net services for both the mentally ill and for other clients in need of protection, such as abused and neglected children. With these goals in mind, just let me comment on a few of the key components of the bill. The expanded benefits portion. We support expanding the mental health benefits for GAMC and Minnesota Care to achieve parity with medical assistance. We believe this change will improve access to mental health services and prevent more costly inpatient care and provide consistent access to services throughout the state. However, we are concerned that the bill does not expand the number of persons eligible for these programs. We know that since the 2003 session have resulted in an overall reduction in the number of persons covered through Minnesota Care and GAMC. In 2004, Mayo Clinic reported to us a $2.6 million in uncompensated care. We appreciate the rationale for moving case management functions into the benefit set in order to retain federal funding for this service. However, counties are concerned about the role of case managers within these health plans. We urge you to assure that the funds currently used by counties for case management are not taken away from counties before the case management function is fully defined and incorporated into the health plans or integrated care networks. We also urge you to include language to assure that case management will not only address mental health care, but also assist people in linking with other critical community services, services such as schools, corrections, courts, etc. We believe that the language in Section 2, Subdivision 2, will help achieve this task, but that the legislature specifically review the report referenced in this subdivision before case management functions are transferred. In regard to infrastructure supports, we applaud the governor and the department for recognizing that in addition to access to medical care, an improved infrastructure is needed to support the transformation of the mental health system, and we support the areas targeted for additional investments. There are two areas that are extremely problematic for us. The first is the county maintenance of effort requirement. We understand and appreciate the importance of keeping mental health dollars in the system. However, with the large reductions in state funds in recent years and the projected loss of up to $94 million statewide in federal targeted case management funding, we think it is unrealistic to tie our hands at this point while we wait for the implications of the federal government's ruling on these. In Olmsted County, the child protection system is an important piece of our children's mental health system, and we may need to redirect resources to offset federal funding reductions in this area. The maintenance of effort provisions in this bill need to be adjusted to permit this type of flexible decision-making. If it is the intent to ensure that funding currently used for mental health services continues to address mental health needs, then comparable provisions must be placed on all funds being shifted to health plans. Specifically, the language must be included that requires that the additional money given to health plans be used to fund mental health care. Secondly, health plans should be required to reinvest in the counties from which the transfer of funds occurred. According to recent information from the Minnesota Department of Health, HMOs in Minnesota made over $218 million over the last 6 years on their PMAP enrollees. We urge you to assure that public funds are reinvested to address public needs, not to underwrite the business losses of other market segments. The second issue that we oppose or is problematic is the increased county cost share on persons placed in 16-bed units and the Anoka treatment facility. People are placed in these facilities and often remain in these facilities for longer periods of time because of a judge's order or a doctor's recommendation. Difficulty in the development of local services is often due to the complexity of the needs of the individual and the challenges of securing basic supports such as housing. If this cost-sharing provision is included in the bill, it should be limited to situations where counties have clear responsibilities for ensuring timely discharge from a state facility with appropriate notification, and there should be clearly stated exceptions to the county cost-sharing provisions related to the court-ordered treatment, medical necessity, or other factors that inhibit our ability to secure appropriate programming. What's missing? We would like to see more investments in primary prevention and more consumer oversight of the mental health system, including activities within the new integrated care system. Olmsted County residents and providers have benefited from the strong involvement by our local community social services advisory board. This community oversight shouldn't be lost and instead should be replicated within the new system. AMC and MICA understand the role of counties in our mental health system will be changing. Please understand that AMC and MICA concerns expressed today are not opposition to reform, but are out of concern for the needs of the mentally ill and our desire to assure that adequate resources remain in place to integrate primary care, mental health care, and critical social services for this vulnerable population. AMC and MICA are committed to work with you and the Minnesota Department of Human Services to make the needed changes in the legislation and to promote system design moving forward. I thank the committee for your interest in mental health reform and taking the testimony today on behalf of Minnesota County Government.
Thank you. We need to be leaving here to get over to the session, so we're really going to get down tight. And if we're not able to cover all the people, we'll just have to ask you for a written testimony that we can distribute. But next is Marion Brandt. Pardon me? Oh. Oh, I called on Peggy Hinkle before. I thought we weren't testifying, that's why. Oh, okay. All right.
I would ask you, though, I mean, we're running out of time, and we had a county position already, so welcome to the committee. I realize you came from ways.
Okay, thank you. My name is Peggy Haglund. I'm the Director of Family Services at Yellow Medicine County, located out in Granite Falls. The reason I came today was to give you, in my opinion, a better picture of what case management means. I know case management is a very critical piece to this. It's something that the counties feel very strongly about. And what I intended to do was give you a picture of what happens when someone is referred to us for case management. I probably don't need to go into all the detail that I had prepared. However, I would like to emphasize the intensity of the services. For example, our caseload sizes for children's services is one case manager to 15 children. For adults, it's one case manager to 40. The issues that we get involved in can run from anything from housing to activities of daily living, cooking, shopping, transportation, completing those same applications that keep people on medical assistance and other programs. I'm jumping here because I want to get to some of this, but I guess what I would like to do is go back and, as you suggested, do some type of written information for the group and ask that you take a look at that, and as you're reading that you do understand what I'm talking about as far as intensity. When case management is provided by county social services, it means face-to-face contacts. It means taking these people to appointments, working with all providers, managing that care, coordinating that care, and ensuring that appropriate services but also quality services are provided. Because of that, what I really like to state is that I feel that counties should be involved in the RFP process, if not the contracting process. I understand there's a conflict of interest if counties are part of responding to the projects. However, I think we have the inside story on what case management is, and to assure that that service is appropriately defined, we would ask that that be allowed. The other statement that I would like to make is that in regards to counties paying for cost of the care in a state hospital, be it a CDHH or a NOCA, that I would rather see those dollars go to community-based services. And my example is that I'm a part of the Southwest 18. It's the 18 counties located in southwestern Minnesota who have an adult mental health initiative. Originally, during the planning, what we had done is looked at our maintenance of effort requirements using the 10% that we used to pay to regional treatment centers. For our 18 counties, that equaled to about $320,000. Our intent was to pool those dollars within the 18 counties and use those dollars to create new housing, new employment opportunities, and other services that would not otherwise be available. If we go back to having to pay for admissions and stays at regional treatment centers or other hospitals, those dollars will be lost. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Marion Brandt? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marion Brandt, and I'm the Executive Director of South Country Health Alliance, a county-based purchasing program in southern Minnesota. I am here to emphasize the need for the coordination of care, the integration of care within these programs. And I would say to you that integration of care needs to take into consideration the Medicare programs. In January of this year, we began enrolling persons with disabilities into our Ability Care program, providing Medicare Part A, Part B, and Part D. This gave our persons with disabilities living in our member counties an option for a local plan that would coordinate those Medicare benefits along with the other services that they are receiving. And so my message to you is to include that coordination of care that's needed at the local level and the integration of all of the services. Thank you
very much. Barbara Fry again.
Chairman Bradley, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Flanagan, Barbara H. Flanagan, and I represent the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. I've also served for 18 years in a leadership position on the Hennepin County Mental Health Advisory Council, and I do have a son who has serious and persistent mental illness, although since he's deaf, he's an outlier, and probably most of this wouldn't affect him much one way or the other. The League of Women Voters did a study in 1988, I believe, right after the passage of the 87 Act. We adopted a position giving special priority, as did the Act, to people with serious and persistent mental illness, and also strongly supported the county's creation of an array of services to support people in the community, which had been conspicuously lacking when the state closed its first state hospitals at Hastings and Rochester. The feeling was then that if you had good medical care, and with the powerful new meds, that apparently would do it. But for many people with serious and persistent mental illness, much more in way of daily support is necessary. The illness also may fluctuate or cycle, so some people who don't need a great deal of care at one point in time may need a great deal of care in a few weeks. It's particularly important, we believe, that these people are assured the continuation of case management, and particularly community support services, which are less expensive than case management, often more flexible, and very do things, for instance, like taking people to medical appointments. In Hennepin County, where there is an estimated 20,000 people with serious and persistent mental illness, more than 3,000 are served by community support programs. Most of them don't have case management, and another about 2,500 are served by case managers, either county or contracted. Our feeling, frankly, is that it is more important to integrate social services strongly to prevent recurrence of hospitalization than it is physical health, although in an ideal world, everything would be integrated beautifully. Our feeling also is that while the program now for mentally ill people is fraught with problems, most of these problems reflect the lack of underfunding and the lack of sufficient services, rather than the fact that physical and mental health are not combined. We would urge you to think very carefully about disbanding the services that were established and are excellent, often though underfunded, by the 1987 Act. This bill would result in a very dramatic restructuring of mental health services, and I think it's important to approach it very cautiously. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll try one for just about a couple minutes. Katie Boone, and then I think we're going to have to adjourn for the day, and we will act on the bill. There are some amendments tomorrow morning. Ms. Boone, welcome to your committee. And I'm sorry, but you got 2 minutes at the most, please.
I do have a handout here.
Great. Okay.
My name is Katie Boone, and I am the co-chair of the Hennepin County Mental Health Advisory Council. I'm a family member, and I have I serve as a volunteer. I'm here today because Hennepin County has 25% of the people in the state with mental illness, and as Barbara said, we have over 20,000 adults with serious and persistent mental illness. I guess one point I'd like to make quickly is that I feel our local advisory councils have been left out of this process. We've not been involved with NHAG. We've not been consulted by DHS on the payment model. We actually had to invite DHS staff to our own meeting to ask them some questions. And we feel as strongly as the League of Women Voters that the support services are the key to making keeping people with serious and persistent mental illness stable, and people need a tremendous amount of service, and we don't think that integrating physical and mental health does a lot if someone doesn't have a place to live or a place to go during the day. I think that we would like to see a slowdown, as our two resolutions have indicated, to take a look at these supportive services. We've identified the unmet needs in Hennepin County as housing with supports, as employment supports, as the crisis or inpatient services that were discussed earlier, and case management. And we would like to see a slowdown and on that portion of the bill until next year so that we would have a chance to be more involved in it. We see very little reference to SPMI in the bill or supportive services, and we feel that that's really going to result in Hennepin County with people falling through the cracks, ending up in the ER, in jail, in Anoka, or dead. And we think that that's a very serious issue. It doesn't matter if you've got the meds if you don't have a place to live. And so I'd be happy to answer questions, but that's, and we'll put some written testimony in as well.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We have three additional testifiers that obviously we won't be able to get to now. If you can get by with giving us materials that we can distribute, that's fine. If you desperately feel you need, I would allow very brief testimony tomorrow morning. We will try to act on this bill as far as amendments and conclusion first thing tomorrow morning in our meeting. We're adjourned.